Call us Cal Ripken podcasting on back-to-back days on this episode of Baseball Barbacast. We're going to talk about Shohei Ohtani returning to Anaheim, the New York Yankees closing out another... We'll talk soon. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that, with a little bit of work and a whole lot of time, could one day throw a baseball 105.5 kilometers per hour. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman, and that's what I call real heat.
Yeah, I feel pretty good about that we could touch 105 kmph. Ben Joyce is going to be our first topic on this Wednesday edition of Baseball Barbacast. Yes, we are going back-to-back days, which Ben Joyce could not do for a while and now seems to be able to do, which maybe had something to do with him being a third rounder. But yeah, we're going to talk about Ben Joyce, a real closer, I should say. Then we're going to talk about Clay Holmes, someone who has not been closing a lot of games successfully recently. And then we're going to talk about Kyle Schwarber, because what he did in Toronto last night after not homering for quite some time was quite the watch. But let's begin, my dear friend Jake Mintz, with Mr. Joyce in Anaheim. And the team he was playing against, the fact that Ben Joyce could kind of seize the headlines from this game maybe is a good place to start.
The fastest pitch ever recorded in the Major League Baseball belongs to one Mr. Aroldis Chapman, who threw a ball 105.8 miles an hour against the Pittsburgh Pirates in 2000, and finish my sentence.
Well, I believe it was 105.9, and the reason I know that is because I believe he has a tattoo of it.
So, pretty sweet.
Yes. So that is
every big leaguer should have to get a tattoo of the hardest pitch they've ever thrown.
Yes, it was 2011.
I like the idea of. Yeah. When do you think he got the tattoo? Like, if he throws 105.9
the next day?
Because it can't be the next day, because if I'm Aroldis and I throw 105.9 on a Tuesday, in my mind, that I'm not done. Like, I think there's another level above that for me. So he probably had to wait at least a year when he realized I'm never throwing that hard again. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, but he got pretty close. He has crested 105 a few times since then. But Ben Joyce going 105.5 last night to strike out Tommy Edman, because the thing about that Chapman pitch is it was a ball. But when this pitch is blown past Tommy Edman trying his best to make contact with two strikes, now we have a highlight. With the 106 showing up on the TV broadcast that will really live on forever. And that's why it is our first topic today.
It's the best highlight ever of a super fast pitch. That simple. The Aroldis one was a faster pitch. Duh. But it's like an up and in fastball that makes Andrew McCutchen back out of the way a little bit. And then the crowd kind of cheers once they realize what just happened. Whereas for this, it was two strikes, two outs, heater on the corner, low and in, Edmund swings and misses, and then Ben Joyce just has the swag walking off the mound back to the dugout. We have never seen anything like this. Like, it's the best. It is the best. And that's why I think, like, it's unfortunate that it's happening to such an irrelevant team right now, that this game doesn't actually mean anything for the Angels, both makes it even more impressive and also kind of underwhelming. But Ben Joyce deserves a whole lot of credit for throwing a baseball 105.5. And I would like to admit, Jordan, that we were wrong about Ben Joyce. That when he was at the University of Tennessee, throwing 102, 103 in low leverage situations for a very good Tennessee team, you and I thought it was a bit of a shtick, that it was not a trick. I mean, throwing a ball that hard is repeatable and impressive, but it was not exactly leading to great results all the time. And so when he was making headlines, you and I were like, well, you know, who's really good is Seth Halverson. Like, that guy's, you know, getting out.
Big leaguer, Seth Halverson.
Right?
Big leaguer. Yeah, I mean, you go back, like, it's not like Ben Joyce didn't have success at Tennessee, but that is an important thing to understand when you do not blame people at all being like, why would this guy go in the third round? That is a completely valid response, because ultimately he was throwing, I think, verified 104 with some radar guns that had him up to 105 in college too. But yeah, they were not using him he was not closing games for them really at all. Zero saves in that season at Tennessee. He was throwing sometimes multiple innings, and then he was throwing really like once a week. There was a lot of time between outings. Now, at the time, he was still not as far removed from a lot of injuries. I mean, this is a guy who had a lot of different injuries during his amateur career, which is both contributed to the degree to which Tennessee was probably being careful with him, but it also lent some skepticism to the idea that this could be a major league reliever that you could count on three times a week. And that's where he's really proven us wrong. You know, that's where, and whether that's a credit to him, whether that's a credit to the coaching staff, the medical staff at Anaheim, he has been able to pitch a good amount. And we've even seen him go back-to-back days a couple times. But that's what's really enabled him to quickly ascend to what is now clearly, especially since they traded Carlos Estevez, the top of the Angels bullpen hierarchy. And he is a show. I know they lost last night's game, but he's what got it to extras. And he is still going to be a spectacle in a way that even in this age of velocity, I think is pretty impressive.
You know, I like to play in one baseball game per year as a washed up D3 reliever who hit so poorly his freshman fall that he was moved to the mound and chose that path over the library.
Yeah.
When I play in my one game per year, I am floored by how fast 80 miles an hour looks when you don't see speed. Now, obviously, major league hitters are doing this all the time. But the idea that Ben Joyce is throwing 25 miles an hour faster than that, it twists my brain into a pretzel. It is 5 miles an hour harder than 100. Now, yes, that's just math, but it's so freaking fast. I did a little, you know, typing on the old computer machine on the calculator box. 0.349 seconds from hand to front of plate. And guess what? If you make contact with Ben Joyce right at the front of the plate, you're probably fouling it off because you need to go out and get that thing. Right? Like it's even less than that. And it's so fast that a human being could do this is just remarkable. And I think it's worth noting he's gonna pass Aroldis, right?
Like, well, that's the last topic here, right? We've just had this conversation as velocity has gone up across the league. Like, what is the fastest pitch we will see thrown? And we've seen, like, in our lifetimes, but even like as we move faster and you think about that the average fastball velocity has gone up so much over the last 20, 10, 5 years. However, and I've made this point before, while there are a ton of guys hitting 100, there is a very shorter list. Every time you go to 101 and 102 and 103 and 104, it's a smaller and smaller, smaller list, which makes sense. Now, ultimately, you have enough guys throwing triple digits. One of those is going to be able to throw 105, and we've learned that with Ben Joyce. Now, 105.5 makes me think, now that we've seen him touch 105 multiple times, it does make me think, in the right situation, with the right amount of rest, against the right opponent, we probably will see 106. We probably will see 106 proper. I know we got 106 on the gun. Here's just a super nerdy note that I learned when I was doing like Jordan Hicks research at some point. Normally, 105.5 does not show up as 106 on the broadcast. Normally, you have to get to 0.6. So I was actually surprised by that, because in my past history of researching fast pitches, normally to get to that upper level, it has to get to 0.6 and not 0.5. Either way, the point is, I think we will see him get to 106 proper. Much higher than that is hard to fathom, but I do agree with you. I think we will see it, whether it's this year, whether it's not. He will probably make history in that sense.
Because adrenaline plays a role. It feels like the type of thing that old-timey baseball people believed and was then proven false by modern science, that depending on the importance of the situation and the environment, that leading to more velocity feels like, you know, the Yiddish word Bubba Misa, right? However, it's totally a thing. It is absolutely 100% real. Last night, Ben Joyce after the game said, quote, "I looked right up after and saw it. It was just a big time game and all the fans were into it. So I feel like that helped a little bit. It was two strikes. So I just tried to give it everything I had." We get Ben Joyce on a contender in a playoff scenario. He's throwing 125. Yeah. I mean, the sky's the limit.
Well, again, you're saying the same thing about, you know, Mason Miller throwing 104 in the empty Coliseum. Like, I think that's why I do believe we'll see it. He's gotten close enough now. It's what for a while when we had guys throwing 103, it felt like a big leap to ask them to throw 106, right? Which Chapman had done. It did not feel like something. If anything, I was like, if anyone's going to do this again, it's going to be Chapman. And we've seen that again this year where he's still been able to touch 104, 105, even all these years later. But I do think we will see it, whether it's this year or not.
Now, I do think there is a worthwhile conversation to be had about whether the uptick in extreme velocity is good for the sport. There were some interesting quotes last night from Whit Merrifield after the Braves game. He got hit in the head and he was talking about how guys are just trying to throw as hard as they can and they're not trying to hit spots. And we've seen that become more of a thing over the last decade or so. That being said, all that in mind, 105.5, brr, that's freaking cool. Like, that's cool, right?
Yeah, I think they are related conversations. Like, there is, again, it's not an accident. Like, hit by pitches are up more than ever, and we're losing guys to broken hands and thumbs all the time, right? Like, that sucks, and I don't like that. However, when we are talking about these individuals that are making history, I think it's worth to pause and then appreciate it.
Fire up the multiple things can be true at the same time, Horn.
Yes.
Throwing baseballs 105.5 is cool, and maybe everybody throwing 99 with no control isn't exactly the best. Let's stick on this game and talk about what we thought was going to be our main topic before Ben Joyce broke our brains. Shohei Ohtani went home. Not to Japan, but to Anaheim. What is home, right? What is home?
Yeah.
That's really getting at the base of this question. His first regular season game back in the stadium where he spent the first 6 years of his MLB career, where he became a legend, a household name, one of the best players in baseball. The organization that gave him the opportunity to prove that he could do both. I think that that is an important note. The Dodgers, the team for which Shohei Ohtani obviously now plays, played a preseason game in Anaheim for the season, and Ohtani got some boos, not alcohol. And so there was conversation about whether or not he would receive a warm welcome, and he kind of didn't receive either kind of welcome because not a whole lot of people were at this game. On the Angels side, Dodgers fans flocked down to Orange County to cheer on their club. What did you make of Ohtani's journey back to where he started it all?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of went how I expected. Like, I think that it's a little bit tough to talk about the fan perspective when we've had a lot of discourse about it. And he was asked about it again, is, oh, the Angels, they didn't match. You know, what a failure. They didn't match an offer. They didn't try to retain him seriously. And like, yeah, that's a you could absolutely criticize the Angels for that, of course. Duh, right? But then how does that translate to the fans who could understandably feel maybe not betrayed, but like, I'm not going to ask Angels fans to not be upset that he went to the Dodgers. I mean, that's pretty basic stuff. He's now tearing it up on the team that you don't like very much. Like, that's pretty understandable. But are you booing him because he, like, are Angels fans aren't happy with the state of affairs either? And that's not Ohtani's fault, right?
They don't so, announce Artie Moreno in the lineup the right. owner of the team before every game, right? It's not like right. this team is managed by Ron Washington and owned by Artie Moreno. Boo.
Right. But because Ohtani's standing up there wearing a Dodgers jersey, he becomes something that represents the failures of the Angels, right? And that's unfortunate. But also because it wasn't a whole lot of booze, and maybe if it was 100% Angels fans, it would have been more of that. And part of that would have been understandable for what I just described. But at the same time, I think Ohtani will always understand. And I think everyone understands that, like, the Angels, for all of their failures, they were the team that managed to convince him, you can do whatever you want here. And for that, I am grateful. There is no way around that.
That's how I feel, Jordan.
That is an absolute fact.
I feel that way about my high school girlfriend who told me that I could be a professional podcaster, you know?
Mm. Not the one you're about to marry.
No, the one I'm about to marry.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Thank you for clarifying. That was an interesting way to refer to your fiance. But to that point, it's like, right, you have to appreciate that you can never take away from them. Everything that went wrong because of it, Ohtani is both every bit the face of it and the last person you should be blaming. So it kind of goes both ways in that weird sense. And I imagine that prompts a lot of complicated emotions from the fans.
Dylan Hernandez of the LA Times dropped some total fire take about this game. This is the headline. Shohei Ohtani returned to Anaheim and proved why Dodger Stadium is a better home. I see no lies. I see no lies, right? I think that him being in LA is better for the sport. He is around competence. He is going to play in October, okay, on the biggest stage.
For the first time?
For the first time? That's great.
Can I just send a stray really unnecessarily? I'm not sure that would have been the case if he signed with the Blue Jays.
Boy, wow.
Apparently, yeah. Maybe not. Maybe Shohei allegedly got in the Blue Jays. But anyway, I'm glad you're saying this because, like, it's so obvious. And yet I've had that thought so many times during this Shohei season where I'm like, yeah, duh. Like, we had that when he first signed with the Dodgers. But it's like, good. Yes. This is where he should be playing. This is great. I am enjoying this. And I'm looking forward to seeing him do it in October.
Seeing him hit a triple down the right field line, sprint around those bases, and then stand next to Anthony Rendon, however, must give those in Orange County a glimpse of what could have been. Instead, whoa, nothing but whoa. However, shouts out to Logan Ohapi, the true face of the Anaheim Angels. He goes yard in this game, the Sable slugger, proving that there is life after Shohei. There is a future. There is a tomorrow, maybe. Who knows? The funniest part of this game, Jordan, was Ohtani comes up in the 10th inning and Ron Washington, the Angels manager, walks him, and then Mookie Betts hits a 3-run homer.
Right. Nice to see Ohapi get homer. He has been really, really struggling the last 2 months. I would encourage you not to look at those numbers. The really encouraging thing is that Reed Detmers looked really good.
Great.
Nice to have him back. So that was nice. But yeah, I mean, this is just kind of the state of play here. And Ohtani is probably exactly where he is supposed to be. And I don't think there is much more to say other than that. All right, let us take a break. And when we return, we will talk about the New York Yankees closer situation. Woo!
Welcome back, Jake Mintz, Jordan Schiesman, Baseball Barber. Neither of us are the Yankee closer. Should we be? No, we should not be. Because it's very difficult. It's a hard job. Mariano Rivera spoiled the Bronx for 2 decades. That being said, Clay Holmes does not inspire confidence. Last night, he surrendered his 11th blown save of the season, allowing a walk-off grand slam to Wyatt Langford, rookie outfielder for the defending World Series champion Texas Rangers. No shame in that. As the Yankees drop behind the Baltimore Orioles topped the AL East for the first time in 2 weeks. And of course, after the game, the vitriol was directed at the tall Alabaman for his inability to lock the ninth inning down. Jordan Schusterman, where would you like to begin with closer gate? Although gate is more of like a scandal. This is this isn't really a scandal.
It's not really right. There's not really like any sort of secret here. What's going on? But I also think that what you just said is the vitriol pointed towards Clay Holmes. I think that this situation, while yes, when the players are not doing their job, like that is basically still the first point you can make, and understandably that is where fans will point at first. But the fact that we are on blown save number 11, I mean, we're probably four or five blown saves past where the first thing I see Yankees fans getting mad about is the decision to keep putting him out there more than how he's actually pitching. And that shift does take some time to get to, but that is where it becomes more of an Aaron Boone conversation, but also more of a larger roster conversation, because this is a great example of people screaming, he can't be the closer anymore. And then you see one respond being like, okay, so who should it be? And then it's like, I don't know, but it shouldn't be him. And then it's like, all right, well, okay, like there has to be a next step. And so that is where the Yankees find themselves in a rather difficult position, because I don't know where I would turn. I too feel like we're probably past the point where I would keep running him out there in the ninth. But I look at this roster and I don't know who I would turn to.
It's not like Josh Hader is just hiding in AAA for you, right?
Right. But to that point, it is an interesting contrast to the Verdugo Jason Dominguez conversation, right? Where that one, it's like, hello, we seemingly have an alternative right here. What are we waiting for? And let's just push that to the side. Let's keep it focused on Holmes. But in this case, it's not that they don't have any other relievers with decent numbers, but they don't really have anyone where it's like, okay, obviously it should be him. I feel like the answer I've seen the most is Tommy Cainley, a guy who has certainly pitched in high leverage and succeeded for the Yankees in the past. But I mean, he's got like a handful of saves over the years. I don't know. You watch this team and you watch this team up close, and you talk about these pitchers and talk to the coaches. Where would you turn here if there was picking an alternative?
I'm not picking an alternative. It's to me, you have to ride with Holmes. I think you continue to ride with Holmes, at least for now, because the best version of the Yankees includes Holmes getting high leverage outs. And right. If you move him out of the ninth inning, you are just whacking that dude's confidence into oblivion. And I think that is potentially more damaging, removing him from any type of important spot, than, you know, the downside of keeping him in the ninth inning. Now, look, he's not been very good over the last handful of months. There's no avoiding that. His style of pitching, where he is throwing a barrage of sinkers that make a lot of weak contact, is not great for the ninth inning. It's fewer strikeouts than you would ideally have in that spot. I think the big issue last night, right, is he allows a one-out single, and then he's thrown from the stretch, and he just gets super out of whack, and he's rushing his delivery and whatever. I think the best option is still Clay Holmes. Now, the reason that's a problem is that the Yankees did not go out and get anybody you would feel confident giving the ninth inning to at the trade deadline. There were some pitchers available. Tanner Scott could have gotten Jason Adam. Carlos Estevez would have been a good fit for them, right? And they clearly had the prospects to do it, if that's the package that the Angels got from the Phillies, which was a good package. Still, the Yankees have those types of players. And I think that's the failure, right? I don't think this is Aaron Boone's fault, if you're going to blame anybody, because what do you want him to do? There's really no one else you could put in. I think this is the front office believing too much in the big league pitching development staff's ability to conjure relievers out of nothing. Matt Blake, who is the Yankees pitching coach, is a wizard, okay? He's a wizard, Harry. Jake Cousins has been spectacular over the last few months. Luke Weaver has been the eighth inning guy all year. They sucked freaking amazing outings out of Michael Tonkin for 3 months. Tim Hill has been really, they do a really good job at this. Spectacular job. And I think that the front office, the people who are making decisions about acquiring players, potentially are seeing that success and saying, oh, well, we don't need to go out and get, you know, big league proven relievers because there's the value in that does not make sense. We can just conjure them up in the lab. And often that is true. And the Yankees are where they are right now, in part because they've been able to do that really successfully. But sometimes just go trade for Tanner Scott, you know?
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. I don't have any retort to that. I would want to go back to the point about the confidence, just because we've kind of had these debates over the years where it's like, well, you think last night helped his confidence? Like, how many more of those? And to your point, it's like for now, like, or as it stands, like, okay, well, I don't know what else more you would need to see. I don't know how many more of these you would need to see. And this is where, if I am going to give a critique of Boone, is that there is a way to take a guy out and put him back in at some point before the games start being really important. But we are probably past that point. And that is where it becomes very difficult, because there probably was a version where, you know, coming out of the All-Star break, or before the All-Star break, or like earlier in August, that you can just be like, listen, Clay's good. We're going to go closer by committee for a week. Sometimes they say this happens. We've seen this with closers where it's like, eh, we're going to change this. And then like a week later, he's saving a game again. First of all, it's these guys' job. It's these guys' job to pitch in whatever situations that they're asked to do. And clearly, like, if you could get a couple good outings from Clay Holmes, because I totally agree with you, like, there's no path to a Yankees World Series that doesn't involve Clay Holmes getting important outs. That's a fact. And I would hope the Yankees fans could also admit that. But I also just think that there probably was a way to ease off earlier, and now they've kind of backed themselves into a corner, partly because of the things that you've described with the roster.
So the other options, right? You mentioned Tommy Canley. I think he'd be fine in the ninth. Jake Cousins, who, by the way, is actually Kirk Cousins' cousin. Did you know this?
Yes. Also, that's an Ivy amazing. Leaguer. We love Ivy Leaguer. We love, yeah.
Cuzzo.
Jake Cuzzo. He's struggled the last few times out. But then the real wild card that we've seen, by the way, we should also mention, just since you mentioned the deadline, they did trade for Mark Leiter Jr., who in theory was brought in to bring in more swing and miss. And while he has, you know, 19 strikeouts in 13 innings, he hasn't been getting outs. So he doesn't really seem like an actual option right now. The real wild card that, you know, I keep seeing people throwing out is Luis Gil, who is the rookie starter who has only started this season. He's currently injured. He's got 124 innings. We've talked about having to maybe move him to the bullpen to preserve his workload. Now, his stuff is absolutely closer worthy. The strikeouts are there, right? He also has the highest walk rate of any starting pitcher. Now, maybe you think that the command becomes better in shorter stints because he's not going longer into games, but you're kind of playing with fire there for like 100 different reasons, both injury related, both asking him to change his role. Like, that seems like such an extreme move that I just would be stunned if the Yankees were to land on that. Like, that would require them to basically decide right now, okay, you're going to the bullpen, but you wouldn't start with him pitching in the ninth. Like, he'd have to get healthy, get right, used to pitching in relief multiple times a week, and start throwing more strikes, and then maybe you have a closer in a month, but that, where then you're throwing a rookie out there in October as your closer, that seems so unrealistic that I kind of want to just move that to the side, but I know a lot of people are calling for it, so I wanted to mention it.
Manager Jordan, earlier this year, we had you tell David Bednar that he's no longer closing games.
No, it was Paul Sewald, actually.
Paul Sewald, sorry. I just assumed it was David Bednar. I need you to sit me, Clay Holmes, down, and I need you to tell me that I'm still your guy, that I'm still your closer, okay? I think I like to do this bit because if you were, my dear friend, hired tomorrow as a minor league director of operations or something, you would do that job incredibly well, I believe. However, I think you could do that job. Maybe not tomorrow, but I think you could do many jobs within an organization. I think you'd be a horrible manager. So I want you to sit me down and I want you to tell me, Clay Holmes, that everything's going to be okay. Go.
But I do, what if I don't believe it's going to? So hold on. You're basically Brian Cashman in this scenario.
I'm Clay Holmes.
No, but I'm saying that like I'm being given this assignment because.
Okay. So I'm Brian Cashman. Right now,
yeah,
I'm Brian.
That's what I'm saying. Okay,
I'm Jake Mintz, actually. But now I'm Brian Cashman. Okay.
Yeah.
GM of the Yankees. Hey, yeah. Aaron. We don't really have a better option right now. I need you to go talk to Clay and let him know he's still the guy.
Got it.
Now, I'm Clay Holmes.
Yeah. Hey, Clay. Your stuff still looks great, and I'm not worried about
it.
Tough one out there. We're going to go right back to you. You're going to be ready to go. You're going to be ready to go in a close game tomorrow, right? I mean, we can count on you, right?
Whatever you need, Skippo.
All right. Then I think I've said all I need to say because I'm not concerned. I'm not worried. And you seem like you're in a great place. That walk-off grand slam, what walk-off grand slam? You're fine, right?
I'm certainly not in a great place because we're currently in Arlington, Texas.
I can't change that. What I can tell you is that I have full faith in you. I'm looking at your Baseball Savant page right now on my computer here at my desk, I still see a lot of red, so I'm not worried.
As all in major league teams use internally, Baseball Savant, they don't have their own systems or anything.
No, they don't. But so I see a lot of red, and I've been told red is good. So I have no issues, and I look forward to handing you the ball in the ninth inning in the next couple of days.
I appreciate the confidence, Coach Aaron. One more question for you. If you guys could just call up Jason freaking Dominguez, please, that would be great for everyone. Thank you
so
much.
We're considering all of our options. And, I know that would probably help, maybe get a few more runs so that you don't have to protect as small of a lead.
Aaron, I'm not Chris Kirschner. I'm not. You could shoot straight, dude.
All right, fine. Clay, you want the truth?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd like it to be on the team. That'd be really nice. I would really like. Hey, Clay, close the door. Close the door. Let me tell you how I really feel. anyway, that's the Yankees. do we have anything else on this before we take one more break?
No, Aaron Judge hitting homer last night.
No, right. That's the thing. Right? So 8 games, season high, and that's unacceptable. Am I seeing 1-for-5 with 2 strikeouts? It's your MVP. All right. Sure. If you say so. Anyway, I think that's it. That's the Yankees talk for today.
Clay Holmes has more blown saves than me in my career.
It's true. It's true. He does. More saves than a lot. More blown saves
also,
than a lot of us.
Much richer.
Yes. That is the other thing. Clay Holmes, free agent?
Fascinating. Hey, do you know what Clay Holmes looked like on the Pirates, by the way?
Yes, of course. Wait, I told this story on the podcast.
Go ahead.
I'll tell this goofy story and then we'll take a break. In 2019, it must have been 2019 or 2018. I was in Pittsburgh because that's where my wife went to grad school. And we were out and having a lovely dinner. And on our walk back, on our walk home, we walked past, we like saw Brian Reynolds out there at some point, and then we saw Colin Moran, and it was like, I guess the Pirates live around this neighborhood. But then on the way back, we saw Clay Holmes, like with a beard, and he's huge, right? So that's the first tip that like, that's probably like a professional athlete, and I had already just
so
seen two other Pirates, right? But I was like, oh, that's Clay Holmes. Now, again, this is when he has like a 6 ERA with the Pirates and nobody knows who he is. And that's when I knew like, oh, man, I'm out here recognizing Clay Holmes in street clothes. This is a tough look for your boy. So, yes, I do know what he looked like on the Pirates.
And this is back when you didn't know how to iron a shirt, too. So it's like
a long time ago.
Developed some skills.
Anyway, yeah. So, yes. Wait, why did you bring that up? Just because he looks very different now?
It's wild.
He doesn't have a beard.
Well, it's not just that he didn't have a beard. Like, he was kind of a very hairy boy. Maybe
hairy guy.
If the Yankees, here you go. It's a Samson situation. Yankees got to let Clay Holmes grow it out, just once, see if that if he starts throwing 105.5 like Ben Joyce. That's the solution. Aaron, hey Aaron, go tell Clay to grow
that'll
it
do
out.
It.
That'll do it. All right, let's take a break. And when we get back, Jordan will cosplay the 29 other man. Welcome back to Baseball Barbagaz. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. Let's head north of the border where the Phillies are right now. Phillies go down 6 runs early, immediately, instantaneously. Tyler Phillips, the local kid, gets plastered by the Blue Jays, does not get out of the first inning, but the Phillies claw their way back, thanks in large part to Kyle Schwarber, who ripped 3 home dingers last night, breaking what was the longest homerless streak of his entire MLB career. Now, it is his 2nd 3-homer game of the season. His last one was on August 7th against the Dodgers. In between those 2 3-homer games, he had a 13-for-92 stretch with 1 homer for a 141, 245, 217 line. That's a 463 OPS across 23 games. Now, a great example of how cherry-picking dates changes a narrative and puts whatever you want out there. If you include the 2 3-homer games in his stats, his line then becomes 22-for-102 with 7 homers and 6 doubles, which is a 216, 308, 480 line. That's a 788 OPS across 25 games. Hilarious.
Yeah, and Schwarber, I mean, was this his first career 5-hit game? I mean, that was the thing that I was wondering, because I know he's had a 3-homer game, as you just mentioned, not that long ago. But, I mean, this wasn't just a 3-homer guy. I mean, this was 3 homers that they would have lost the game without. They end up winning the game by 1. This was a pretty impressive. And listen, I know these Blue Jays pitchers are trying their best, but when we see how high the Blue Jays end up with the draft pick, depending on their lottery luck, this is a game. These are the games, the teams that are, you know, trying to lose over the final 6 weeks. It's like they sure found a way to lose that one. And those young Blue Jays hitters sure are doing their best. They have played very well since they traded away their entire team. Vlad had 4 hits. We got Springer back at the top of the lineup. But, man, Will Wagner's swinging it. Spencer Horwitz is like Addison Barger's hitting home runs. But the Phillies needed this. They needed to come back here because while the Tyler Phillips start was, I guess, in place of Taijuan Walker, correct? He is essentially replacing Taijuan Walker in the rotation. Taijuan Walker still pitched in this game and managed to give up a couple runs again out of the bullpen. But, I mean, yeah, Schwarber is one of the just flip the switch guys that we have. And it's pretty cool when it all comes together, especially because, like, when he's I think the 3rd home run was at a 9 or 10 pitch at bat. Like, you just know you're just dialing it in and it's just a matter of time.
Yeah,
if you're going to throw him another pitch in the zone, that the next one is either going to be another foul ball or it's going over the fence for a homer.
People often ask us the following question. Who is your favorite baseball player? You get that a lot, right, from people?
Yeah, yeah.
And
pretty standard question in our line of work, although it becomes a little bit different now because it is our line of work.
And I think that, you know, I always struggle to answer that question. I think Spencer Strider would have been my answer last year, the end of last year, even this spring training. Watching Kyle Schwarber when he's locked in is a singular experience because it feels inevitable. Like, you watch the whole last at bat, it's like, well, if he throws him one more fastball in the zone, this is going to be a souvenir. I don't know. I being around teams gives you a different type of appreciation for players. And I think I don't want to say devalue, but like when you are around people and you see the way they interact with their teammates and the coaches and the media, whatever, you maybe like we should just be appreciating Shohei Ohtani and Aaron Judge the most because holy crap, watch them play the baseball. Mm-hmm. But Kyle Schwarber is just an absolute wonder. He is a delight. He is.
Yeah.
I love watching him hit. I just love it.
The way he does it is pretty unique. I would say that his style of hitting is in some way like kind of what you like to say, oh, this is everyone's just the three true outcome guys now. That's just what baseball is. It's like, I mean, kind of, but like stylistically and really mastering that craft, like that's really only him. And he's now done it for a long time. And that's really what makes him so impressive. And he's leading the league in walks again. He's at 31 homers. I mean, he's probably not, you know, he had 46 and 47 in his first 2 years in Philadelphia. He's probably not getting to that again this year. I feel pretty good saying that because, you know, he did have some more prolonged cold stretches this year. He wasn't hitting the ball in the air quite as often as you would maybe want for a guy with this profile. But at the same time, it's working about as well as you could possibly hope.
He's on pace for his highest OPS plus as a Philly, right? Sure. And then, dude, he's going to be a free agent after next season. Like, he might just get freaking paid again by someone.
Yeah. Probably. I mean, again, he has been a very safe bet, right? Like, you kind of know what you're getting. He has an identical slugging percentage as he did a year ago. The OBP is a lot higher. But again, it's just like he hasn't. The homers haven't come quite as consistently to the point where he's not going to get to 45 again. But even still, that is a player that if you're betting on players to hit 40 home runs next season, he's still one of your first picks. And it's not even a question.
I talked to him recently, probably going to write this up, about his transition to full-time DH. I think in our minds as baseball watchers, we saw Kyle Schwarber, this slightly pudgy, big swinging, slow guy, and just thought, why is this not a DH? This guy is just going to be a DH. In Schwarber's mind, I mean, he was a catcher for so long. And when you're a catcher, you see yourself as part catcher, part hitter, total baseball player. When there are types of baseball players, I'm not going to say Schwarber is this, who like look down on DHing because it requires less of you. And I talked about this in the MVP context that there is less wear and tear. And Schwarber straight up told me, like, he's like, this is the best I've ever felt as a big leaguer because I don't have to run around and throw my body in the outfield. That's a double-sided thing because he's like, dude, I feel awesome. I would love to go out and play outfield. I think if right now I was in the outfield, like, I would be really good. I would be better than I was in previous years because I feel fast. I feel healthy. But kind of having to humble yourself for the betterment of the roster is interesting. Schwarber still sees himself as someone who's capable of playing the outfield. Now, whether that's true or not, we can debate. He's only DHing because it's what's the best thing for this particular team at this particular time. But having to learn how to spend all that free time. Think about how much more free time you have as a DH compared to an outfield.
Sure. Well, but and listen, I know that he hasn't caught for a long time, but I am glad you mentioned that because, you know, normally when we're talking about DH types, we are talking about either corner outfielders or first baseman. And from when we talk about the defensive spectrum, going from first base to DH is that's as close as it gets, right? Versus going from catcher to DH is like literally the opposite because you're going from the toughest defensive position to the no defensive position, which is obviously that's a transition that he made much earlier on in his career. And certainly he was still playing a lot of outfield recently and maybe still will in the future. But yeah, from a mindset perspective, from someone who it's hard to be a catcher that isn't, you know, really ingrained in what it means to be a part of the whole facet of your team and of your pitching staff and of figuring out how to hit, like all those things. That is the hardest job. It is the busiest job there is. So I think that's a really interesting transition.
Last thing I want to talk about before we get out of here, Justin Verlander. So Verlander pitched on Labor Day on Monday and was not particularly good. He has made 3 starts since returning from the IL with neck discomfort. He was in the first one and then bad in the last two. Justin Verlander has 260 career wins. I wrote about over Yahoo. Good website that we work for. Disclaimer. We work there, but it's still good. How Justin Verlander wants 300 career wins. And why he wants 300 career wins in particular is that if Justin Verlander gets there, he will probably be the last player to reach 300 wins. There are 24 players who have ever gotten to that level. He missed basically two full seasons in 2020 and 2021 and recorded just one win between those 2 years because he got Thomas Johnson. And now he sits 40 wins away at 41 years old. He has been very public that he wants to play another handful of seasons to not, he has said on the record, not to me, but he has said that it's not the only reason he's still playing, but it is certainly a factor, right? What do you make of his chase for 300 wins?
Yeah, I mean, it's in the headline, right, of your story. It's not going to be easy. 40 wins is a lot of wins, especially when, as we know, it ain't really all in your control. Now, playing for the Astros certainly helps in theory, but as we've seen over the last couple times out, it's not that simple. You still have to kind of pitch to a certain level on your own. Things just have to go right for you on multiple fronts. Now, the thing is, but the Astros are an important part of this equation, right? I think that is, if we are projecting forward and we do assume that he wants to keep pitching, based on how they have acted in the past and how what they did to reacquire him at his age, you would assume that they would keep him around as long as he wants. But there, we are already at the point where we're wondering if he's one of their five best pitchers. And for him to just assume that he will continue to be given these opportunities over and over, whereas the Astros are going to be his, in theory, best chance to continue to win games, it's just really hard to fathom. It's really, really, really hard to imagine him racking up 40 more wins when, I mean, it's, I don't have to, whatever, the math is the math. I mean, 20, even 10 wins a year is tough. So, I don't know.
And that's new, right? So, the game has changed. Yeah. Pitchers, starters get fewer wins than they ever have because they're throwing fewer innings. Pitchers, starting pitchers throw, on average, a full inning less now than they did like 30, 40 years ago, right? And the shorter you work, the less likely it is you reach the necessary five innings to earn the win as the pitcher. Now, pitcher wins are no longer used as a predictive stat to evaluate players. That being said, they still matter to the pitchers themselves. It is something that they definitely care about. Jordan, there are 18 active players over 100 wins, okay? Just to give people a sense for how many 300 wins is, right? There are 18, just 18 active pitchers over 100, and Verlander is going for 300.
How many are over 200?
Three. They are?
Okay. Kershaw.
Yep.
Who's the third one?
Verlander.
Who's still Verlander and?
Max Scherzer.
Who is still active, technically, hopefully.
Jordan, let's do a little game. Okay, yep. So those are the three that are between 200 and 100. I want you to tell me the guys, or sorry, those are the three over 200. I want you to tell me the other 15 active players
that have
over 100 wins.
I'm going to miss some obvious ones because this is a long list and I'm just going to try to rattle off some ones along the way. So I'm just going to start naming some old pitchers. Lance Lynn. Does Lance Lynn have 100 wins?
142.
Okay. Thank you. We already said Kershaw. We already said Scherzer. Okay. I think DeGrom is DeGrom even there?
No.
No, he's not, right? He's at like 80 or 90. Okay. I'm going to go with some more older pitchers. I'm going to go with Waka.
No.
Okay. Garrett Cole has 100
Garrett
wins.
Garrett Cole. So I think Garrett Cole is the most interesting thing on this list because he's at 151. Okay.
Yeah, so
Garrett Cole has
there.
Been the the best pitcher over the last half decade, basically.
Yep.
And he is turning 34 on Sunday.
Yep. Yep.
And he's basically halfway there. So it's just so hard to get to 300 wins.
Robbie Ray.
No.
No. Kevin Gausman.
Yes, at exactly 100.
And so does Patrick Corbin, I believe, just passed this 101 or 102. 102.
Good.
Patrick Corbin's on a W3. Don't let Corbin get hot here. All right. It took him a while to get that 100.
Someone is going to sign him this winter, and it's going to be great.
Okay. Chris Sale has 100.
Yep. 136. One of his teammates.
Charlie Morton has 100.
137.
Is Johnny Cueto technically active?
He is. He is 144.
I don't know if he is going to pitch again, but he definitely fits that description. Let's go with Luis Castillo, maybe?
No,
he's certainly not winning much recently. we will go with, nope, that seems like a bad guess. Who are the other old pitchers? Nope, there's no way he has 100. I don't know. Let's go with... Nope, that's another bad guess. I'd rather
two more guesses. Two more guesses.
Okay. I mean, again, I know there's some obvious ones that I'm certainly missing. Let's go. No, he doesn't have it. All these guys are too young. Like I was gonna say, Pablo Lopez. There's no way he has it.
All right, here you go.
I told you this is not. This is too many names, and I'm forgetting some obvious ones. So who you got?
Kyle Gibson, 112.
Oh. Kyle Gibson. I said Lance Lynn. Why didn't I say Kyle Gibson? Yeah.
Carlos Carrasco, 110.
Sonny Gray,
110.
Yeah. Should have stuck with the Cardinals.
Wade Miley, who hasn't pitched this year.
Wow. He has pitched this year, but not very much.
Because he got hurt.
Yeah.
One you should have gotten is Yu Darvish.
Okay. Also, not top of mind, but yes, definitely Darvish. Yep.
One that is understandable you didn't get is Dallas Keuchel.
Okay. Don't feel super bad about that. Sorry, but he certainly won a lot. Yep.
Two that you definitely should have gotten. The last two are Aaron Nola and Zach Wheeler.
Okay. Yes. Honestly, Wheeler, I wasn't totally sure. Nola, I absolutely should have gotten. I think Nola has more than Wheeler, but I could be wrong about that.
So again, 100 wins. That's 100 wins. Jacob DeGrom is not at 100 wins.
Again, okay? I don't
Justin
like,
Verlander getting to 300 is bonkers.
I mean, 300 is not, it's just not going to happen. Like, we will just readjust it and it will just become 200. That's
But that is for. Why yeah. It should be 250, honestly. But that is why it should be 250. It should be 250. Like,
What are we saying? I'm just saying, like, it's that, that's why it's like, it's all made up, right? I mean, 250 is not, 250 is not going to happen for any of these guys. Once we get past Scherzer and...
Yeah,
and
there's only 25 pitchers that got to 300. That's the 24. Like, that's the thing. Right. It should be really hard. I don't want to lower that barrier too low. The other thing, right, is he's at 3,400 innings. The fewest innings career for any 300-win pitcher is Randy Johnson. He's at, like, 4,200. So it's not as if Verlander has failed to win at an adequate rate. It is the total amount of pitching that he has not yet to do.
And to that point, I think that is the real reason why, even though we can look at it and say this is impossible, it's not going to happen. Clearly, the reason why he thinks he can is two things. One, what you just described, which is that all these guys get to like 4,200 innings, and I still feel like I can throw another 1,000 innings, even though I'm 41. Like, he clearly feels that way. When you combine that with the fact that his first season, or his last season before he got hurt, he won 21 games. And his first season after he got hurt, he won 18 games. He's probably just thinking like, oh, I'll just do that again a couple more times. But as we're learning this year, it ain't that simple, buddy. So, I mean, maybe he's right. Maybe he will just be back to good enough Justin Verlander to throw 200 innings again next year at age 42. And the Astros will win another division and he'll win 15 or 20 games. But boy, is it going to be hard.
If I'm Justin Verlander, who's about to be a free agent, I'm signing a league minimum deal with the Dodgers. I'm just racking up wins, baby. In my contract with the Dodgers, if I'm Justin Verlander, you need to leave me in for 5 innings every start. I have to finish 5. If you take me out before the 5th and it is not an injury, I get to become a free agent on the spot immediately. Who says no? The Dodgers.
Probably the Dodgers. But yeah, that will be interesting if he does go somewhere else this winter, or if he continues to think that Houston is going to be the spot for him. Seems unlikely he will be returning to Queens, although I guess never say never. All right, that's a Wednesday episode of Baseball Barbacast. You can email us at baseballbarbacast@gmail.com. We will take a much needed break tomorrow on Thursday. Day off. Oof. Sure could use that. We'll be back on Friday. Didn't think Jake was going to be podcasting on Friday since he's getting married on Sunday, but it sounds like he will be. We will be recording on Friday morning before I fly to closer to where the wedding will be. And how you feeling? Doing all right?
I'm good. What should I put in the, you know, the hotel goodie bags? Anything you want in there? Tin of chaw. Again, you want some chaw?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, it's just a matter, like, the only thing you open is just like, what are the snacks? So,
yeah,
you know.
I'm not a big snack guy. You know that about me.
No, I know that. I know that. But again, you gotta think about your guests here. It's not about you anymore. I mean, it is about you. But this specific task is not about you. So,
as someone who adores the limelight, okay, this is my weekend, boy.
That's true. But it's my gift bag. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz. Thank you all for listening. Well, leave us a rating, a review. Let us know what you think of the show. We appreciate it. And be nice, because Jake's about to get married. Keep him in a good mood. We'll talk to you all on Friday. Goodbye.
You have to be nice. You have to. Sorry. Let us know what you think of the show, but be nice.